Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz interview series with jazz pianist, composer, and educator Theo Hill. This cat is New York City through and through, baby. He's another dynamic jazz soul etching his story on the keys and the cauldron of the New York City jazz scene, and he loves it. Over the course of our conversation, we talked about his first trip to Smalls at the age of 16, what show in the history of shows he'd love to see via a jazz time machine, what is next, and the best description of his life via a Google search, along with much, much more. Dig it, my friends.
What's going on, man?
Not much, man. Waiting for your call.
Right on. Hey, thanks for taking a little time out for me today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, come on, man. I'm really touched that you thought of me, and I'm really excited, man.
The first thing I want to do real quick is ask you what has been going on with you lately.
Well, I mean, you're kind of catching me on my first day off in over 2 weeks.
Wow.
I've been playing I pretty much played just about every night somewhere in New York.
Wow.
And lately, unfortunately, I haven't been touring as much as I'd like. You know, I haven't really left the country in, I think, about 5 months or so.
Yeah.
6 months. So, which, you know, for me is a little unnerving because I really would, you know, a lot of the time rather be out on the road and touring.
Cool.
But it's actually, you know, a nice balance that I have right now because I'm able to really just stay in New York and, you know, work almost as much as if I was touring, but
right,
all in the city. And the beauty of that, it's kind of a blessing and a curse, you know, in that, unfortunately, I'm not able to work with, like, the same band night after night, you know, which definitely has its drawbacks. But, you know, as a balance, I've been really working as a sideman with different bands on a nightly basis. So I get to work with a lot of cats and learn a lot of different kinds of music and play a lot of different styles of music, you know.
That's cool, man.
Which has its own challenges. So I haven't had a day off since the 30th of March.
Wow. That's
so,
staying busy.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's really busy. And even though I have an off day like today, I mean, I have lots of shedding. I have writing. I'm preparing for a bunch of shows coming up.
Cool.
With my own group and then also as a sideman, you know.
Well, that's a good problem to have, huh?
It really, New York is really where I'd rather be anyway. It keeps me inspired. You know, every night here in New York, it's like a jam, you know, it's like a jazz festival, you know. It's like the greatest jazz festival that they have, you know, anywhere else. But it's like almost like on a nightly basis here in New York, you know. You could see so many amazing cats in between, you know, what's happening at the Blue Note, at the Vanguard, at the Standard, at Dizzy's, at Smalls, at 55. You know, it's like there's so many different places and there's so much going on.
That's beautiful.
You know, I love New York, you know. That's why I'm here, you know.
Yeah. Well, speaking of New York, your roots began in Albany. What was it like? What was it about Albany that gave you that infusion to want to get into jazz?
Well, honestly, my love of jazz and my exposure to jazz, came through my parents,
right?
Who were my dad was a jazz aficionado. He was a drummer, not by profession, but you know, was a jazz lover and was, you know, had all of the 50s Blue Note records, and he used to quiz me on, you know, he'd say, "Who's this playing saxophone?" You know, when I was a child, and I'd be like, "How am I supposed to know, Dad?" And he'd be like, "This is John Coltrane," you know. And eventually I got old enough to the point where when he'd ask me, I'd be like, "This is John Coltrane," you know? So, you know, it was always in my house, always playing. My mom was a dancer, and my parents bought the piano for me before I was born. You know, my grandfather was a pianist, and I had a lot of pianists on my father's side of the family, a lot of musicians. So, you know, I was always kind of around the music and playing, and it wasn't really until I was 12 years old that when I began studying with Lee Shaw, that I really made, you know, I really gravitated towards jazz, and began learning. And it was really, if I had to credit anyone with my, you know, pursuing jazz and my love of jazz, it would really be through, my teacher Lee. You know, who who was just instrumental, one of the most giving, beautiful teachers. She herself was a student of Oscar Peterson. And she used to play with, you know, she lived and spent a long time in New York. She used to play with people like Paul Chambers, you know.
Wow, yeah.
And she's from Oklahoma. She's still playing. And she's just such an inspiration to me. You know, she made me tape record every lesson. And she really got me, you know, she really got me going. So in Albany, it really was kind of difficult. You know, when I was coming up, there weren't a lot of clubs. There weren't a lot of people, young people my age, who, you know, to play music with. So I ended up playing initially with a lot of, like, music teachers. You know,
yeah.
Like the music teachers at my high school or at the junior high school or something like that, they would have a gig and I would play with them when I was just, you know, very young. And I remember playing at a lot of the jazz clubs around, you know, around the Albany, in downtown Albany, with different cats like George Muscatello and Dave Calarco. I mean, there was a scene, but it was mostly older guys, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure how I found out about it, but for my 16th birthday, I had my parents take me to Smalls. And we went down to the city. You know, my parents are both from New York City, so we stayed down there. And I finally got the courage, you know, and we hung out all night until like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And I finally, you know, was able to sit. And I remember, you know, being scared shitless. You know, I was completely, you know, petrified of sitting, because especially there was this amazing pianist by the name of Sasha Perry,
yeah,
who still, I consider him to be one of the greatest pianists of his generation, and is one of the torchbearers for playing, you know, a real bebop in the style of Bud Powell and Thelonious Monk. So, I mean, I remember, you know, watching him play, and it was like, I was so scared, you know, and I didn't want to do it, but that's what I was there for, and I think that really, you know, showed me that there was a life outside of Albany, you know, that there was a community, a vibrant community there in New York, and it kind of, you know, that was then that I discovered, like, wow, there's a, you know, there's this world out here, and I could really make it a profession, and I could be around other young people who are really into the same thing, you know.
Yeah.
That was a real game changer, you know.
So since you were a kid, did you know you were getting into music? Was that your lifelong pursuit?
Not really. I always enjoyed it. You know, I always loved playing. I always loved performing. I don't really think I knew that it would end up being my profession, and, you know, that I would end up making my life out of music when I was that young. You know, when you're a kid, I was, like, into sports and, you know, school and hanging out with buddies and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So it really was an evolution, you know, to the point where when I got to be around 16, it was like, well, what am I going to do for school, you know? It's like, I might as well apply to every jazz department I can, you know? That was when I realized that I really wanted to be around other young people and to be immersed in the music, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
But no, I never started, like, I thought it was going to be a profession. It was always just something that I did. I did it out of the love of it. You know, it pleased my parents. I'm an only child, so it definitely made them happy. Initially,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I remember playing as a kid, and, you know, at like 5, 6 years old, you know, I knew it just, they liked it when I did, so I just did it, you know?
Yeah.
But eventually there came a time when you start to, you know, as opposed to doing it for your parents or for somebody else, you start to love it yourself, you know, and then you develop a sense of pride, and, you know, you can, like, say, hey, look what I can do, and look what I, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So when you finally did go to school, you went to the Jazz Conservatory at SUNY Purchase. What did you learn there? Was there a breakthrough with you and your playing and crossing over into jazz? What happened there with you?
Well, I really would have to, you know, credit my two main influences while I was studying at SUNY Purchase, Charles Blenzig and Hal Galper. My first 2 years at SUNY Purchase, I studied with Charles. And he used to run the jam session at the Blue Note on Fridays and Saturdays. So, you know, I'd study with him, and we did lots of transcribing. He was one of the most giving teachers I could have ever asked for. You know, we used to sit and transcribe Kenny Kirkland, and we'd play duo, and, you know, he was also a drummer, so we'd play duo, you know, piano and drums, and he would test me with all these, all these rhythmic, you know, polyrhythms and things like that, and test me with all these harmonies. So it was great, you know, having one-on-one interaction with him, but the real school with Charlie B came on the weekends when we would drive down to the city, and he would play his set with his, you know, with his trio, and then he would bring me and a couple of my other buddies who were all students of his up to sit in at the Blue Note, you know?
Sure, sure.
And that was really, you know, a forging ground, a proving ground for what I, you know, for what I'm still doing today, what I'm still trying to do today. But that was really some of my, you know, my first experience is getting to play on a big stage with really serious players. I got, you know, the opportunity to play with people like Essiet, Eric Harland, Sean Connolly, Donald Edwards, a lot of guys who were in Charles's trio, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, I just played with Essiet, you know, last week. So these are still relationships that I've still been able to hold on to, and guys who I've had the, you know, the honor and privilege of making music with, you know, for over a decade now.
Yeah.
So all that came from my, you know, from Charles, you know, who was, and the great thing about him was that there was like no ego, there was no secrets, no, you know, he was just like, what do you want to know? What is it? You know, what is it that you want to hear? What is it that you can't hear? What do you want to work on? And it was just all open, you know.
Yeah.
It was really, I'm so thankful for Charles. And after 2 years of studying with Charles, then I studied with Hal Galper, who was another, I mean, I think really he's a genius educator. You know, on top of being, I mean, such an amazing pianist, having worked with Cannonball Adderley and Stan Getz and the Brecker Brothers, and I mean, you name it, you know?
Yeah.
But Hal really has an incredible teaching method. He calls it the technique of extremes,
yeah.
Where, you know, he'll kind of evaluate you and kind of see where you are in certain levels, and he'll force you to do something in a totally opposite way, in a totally drastic and extreme way to what you're comfortable with.
Yeah.
Just to kind of put you in, make you feel very uncomfortable, to get you, you know, kind of to see, have a totally opposite perspective from where you are.
Yeah.
With the idea that then you can eventually pull back away from that extreme and find some kind of middle ground.
Yeah.
To find your own voice. And working with Hal was just such an honor and a privilege. I still go back to the tapes and the practice, you know, tapes and the many of the notes that I took working with Hal, because he gave me like 50 years of study, you know, in 2 years. You know,
that's
I'm
cool.
Still working on it, you know.
Yeah.
Still working on it. And that's the thing about this music and, you know, about jazz, about improvised music. You know, it's like the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. And there's always something to be worked on. There's always some, you know, to get to some new level. And it's just, you know, it's so humbling.
Yeah, so humbling. Yeah, that's a great thing, man. So you're a New Yorker through and through. You've been all over the scene, all over the town. Tell me what the greatest thing about New York City is.
Oh, man. Well, for me, it's like all the amazing drummers and bass players that we have here, you know.
Yeah.
But, no, I mean, the level of musicianship here is unlike any other place that I've been to.
Yeah.
And it's constantly changing. We've got about 400 or 500 young kids coming into the jazz universities every year, you know. So places like New School, Manhattan School, Juilliard are just pumping out more and more artists, you know. And then other artists from all over the country, all over the world gravitate here. So, you know, you just, it's a constant, we are always getting like the best and the brightest and the next cat on the scene and the next up and coming generation. And it's an energy that really keeps you motivated, keeps you inspired, you know. It's, for me, it's, you know, I'll always be in, you know. It'll be very hard for me to leave.
Yeah, yeah, it sounds infectious. That's great.
You know? Yeah.
So speaking of places all over the world, you've been to Australia, Austria, Croatia, France. You go down the list, and, you know, South Korea, and all these countries, what country or countries go the most gonzo for jazz? Just like something that just blows your mind when you see him live.
Yeah, well, I mean, Japan really is an amazing place to work as a jazz artist. You know, not only are the audience so knowledgeable about the music, you know, I mean, I feel like in Japan they have more of a, you know, have more of a sense of really a pulse and a heartbeat of what's happening in New York than even New Yorkers do, you know?
Yeah.
And in Japan, they still have record stores. Imagine that, you know? So
yeah.
You can go to a Tower Records and see your record on the shelf. And you can go to all these, you know, the disc unions and the different kinds of places where you can go and pick up all these bootleg DVDs and all these, you know, bootleg concerts that you could never get in the States, you know?
Yeah.
So really working in Japan, plus they're, you know, they work with such a level of precision and detail and, you know, and care that is, I mean, that was really incredible for me to experience coming from the United States, you know, when you're dealing with so many sound people and venues that really don't care and don't have this stuff together.
Yeah.
So for so many different reasons, Japan is a wonderful place for me to work, and I had an amazing experience there. But, you know, every audience is different, and I've had incredible audiences in many of the countries, you know, where I performed. Japan, you know, was certainly exceptional, but I've toured India 8 times. I've performed in over like 20 or 30 cities in India.
Yeah.
And major cities, but also tier 2 cities, and I've been on State Department tours. And so we brought jazz to these places, these rural parts of India where people had never even heard jazz before.
Yeah.
And the people went absolutely nuts. You know, they go bonkers too. So, it, you know, you kind of, you know, there's never a perfect gig. There's something, you know, there's always something bound to go wrong, you know, whether it be the sound or the money or the location or the travel or, you know, something like that.
Sure.
But there's nothing like, having said that, right?
Yeah.
For me, there's nothing really like a New York audience, in my opinion.
Yeah.
There's something about the energy, especially down at places like Smalls Jazz Club, which has really become like a home for me. It's like no other audience in the world, you know?
Yeah.
And it's the real, you know, if it goes over, you know, in a small jazz club in New York, you can probably get over anywhere else.
Yeah.
Okay, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's almost like a litmus test, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, we've kind of covered places, and you've touched on people that you've gigged with. I mean, you've shared the stage with people like, you know, Bobby Watson and all the way down the line, Gregory Porter.
What is it like to be on the stage with people like that? What do they teach you? What kind of energy do you feel? How do you feel about it?
Well, I've been privileged to really to apprentice and have mentorship of, you know, of many older, experienced veteran jazz musicians. And that's really how I got my beginnings playing this music and where I learned the most, especially in my, you know, in my early formative years.
Yeah.
Especially playing in small little dives, mostly in Harlem. At places like St. Nick's Pub, Lennox Lounge, and Mitten's Playhouse.
Yeah.
Now, since I first came to New York, you know, since the early 2000s, you know, New York and Harlem has really changed a lot. You know, it's really gentrified. You know, all three of St. Nick's and Mitten's, I mean, St. Nick's and Lennox Lounge are no more. But it was there that I got to work with people like Bill Saxton, Curtis Lundy, Greg Bandy, where I get to, you know, talk to people like Olu Dara, you know, who are like almost like griots.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And really elder statesmen in the music, guys who had paid dues and played with everybody, you know, guys who had devoted their lives to music for 30, 40, 50 years.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so those were some of my first experiences, you know, just, you know, getting seasoned, you know, getting really getting my ass kicked.
Yeah.
Which is really amazing. You learn every, you know, I do work as a leader, but I really do, the majority of my work is as a sideman, as an accompanist, you know? And, of course, I like to solo. Everybody likes to solo, but I feel like I make my bread and butter. You know, I really, you know, most of my work comes from being an accompanist. And, and you know, studying the art of improvised accompaniment.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
That being said, you know, working with Gregory Porter, you know, I got to work with him a lot. And when he first got to New York, you know, is one thing. And then working with Carmen Lundy is another, you know. And then working with, you know, a Jasmine Horn or, you know, I mean, each one has its own set of challenges.
Right.
You know, and expectations. And that's where, you know, playing in different kinds of styles, being able to interpret a piece of music on just first glance or first listen, or, you know, being able hearing a piece of music or someone's interpretation of it and then bringing your own voice to the table, you know, that's really the art of it, you know, and it changes from situation, from band, you know, situation to situations, band leader to band leader, you know, because some band leaders really wants you to give you the freedom to be yourself. And some band leaders have a very clear and focused idea of exactly what they want, and they want you to do something in a very specific way.
Yeah.
So I'd say that each one of those, you know, people that you could see that I've worked with has really kind of allowed me to develop my own voice in a very distinct way.
Yeah.
And because I've had the privilege of working with so many different kinds of artists and playing so many different kinds of styles, I really, you know, I feel like that's really helped me to become the kind of musician that I am today, you know?
Yeah, and you've talked a lot about mentors and teachers and being around all kinds of different cats that you play with. You're a teacher yourself. You teach master classes and private lessons. What do you try to teach your students about approaching music and jazz?
Well, I mean, the first off is that I still consider myself a student. So that's, you know, I feel like when I am, you know, I'm mostly teaching on a one-on-one basis, mostly with piano students, but I have some drum students and some horn students as well. And, you know, it's a learning process that we go through together, you know, and things that I am telling them are things that I'm at the same time really telling myself. And reinforcing myself, you know.
Sure.
But, you know, I've got some things that I've taken from Hal. You know, I really have tried to actually, you know, go on and teach many of the concepts that I first learned with Hal. But, you know what, each student that I have has their own set of needs and desires and goals, you know. So I kind of like to customize my approach with each student based on what they need, you know, or what I think I hear they might need, or trying to help them out with the kind of skills that will help them be able to work as a sideman, to be
Absolutely.
Able to get a gig, you know,
yeah.
Because, you know, a lot of people want to play, you know, the great solo or have all the technique or things like that, but really, when you get out here and you get out of school, it's, you know, it's about trying to land a gig.
Yeah.
You know, and to try to keep a gig. And, you know, most of that is about preparation and opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, so, but I love working. I've been teaching since I was probably, you know, in my teens. And I taught beginning piano, you know, to young kids and teenagers for many years. But I feel like I've really hit a really great vein of amazing students in the last few years working through New School. And now I'm seeing some of my students you know, graduate and blossom into these amazing players, you know?
Yeah.
So it feels really good to be able to give back. It feels really good to be able to share, you know, the kinds of things that I've learned and the kinds of things that I work on with other young people who are really committed to make it, you know, to playing this music and to making careers out of making music.
Sure.
And it's great for me too, because it could, you know, it's great to have that kind of young energy and be around young cats who are, you know, still really excited about music and still really excited about the scene, and, you know, to show them show them artists or techniques or, you know, rhythms or harmonies, you know, for the first time. It's really exciting.
Yeah, that's cool.
And so, I love it. You know, I love
it. Yeah, and that's beautiful. So all of those early years when your dad had all those vinyl albums around you and you were growing up with all that music, was there one album you popped on the turntable and was like, oh, my God, this is blowing my brains out here?
It would be hard to say one because we had volume, you know, like the whole walls were just covered with vinyl and CDs, you know? He was like just a CD junkie. So, Sonny Clark, pianist like Sonny Clark, Red Garland, Wynton Kelly, Ahmad Jamal.
Yeah.
You know, my dad had all of the records, every single one. Yeah. You know, like Red Garland, he had like every Red Garland record, you know?
Yeah.
Which at the time, I didn't really understand. I didn't really know. I was like, it's Red Garland, what's that? But, you know, those records were kind of like, ended up becoming a part of me. You know, I can still put on some of those records and I can still sing the bass solos and know the drum comping, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, all those records, Art Taylor, Philly Joe, PC, you know.
Yeah.
So to say that there was one, it would just be too hard.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's so much amazing music out there, you know?
Well,
but definitely 50s Blue Note was, you know, a huge concentration for me.
Yeah.
And still playing in a hard bop, post bop style, you know, of course there was tons of Bud and Thelonious Monk. My dad was also a huge fan of Horace Silver. That's one person who I could really identify with. And his just whole concept and the way that he comped and that rhythmic kind of, you know, I mentioned all of those musicians because of the way, not just that they play as leaders, but the way that they play as accompanists.
Yeah.
People like Sonny Clark, people like Red Garland, you know, who are like real, Wynton Kelly, who are just, we call them comp meisters, you know, guys who really understood comping.
Yeah.
You know, all those guys were really a huge part of my development and learning and growth, and still are, you know?
Yeah,
I was
sure.
With PC and I put on some PC and Philly Joe last night at 3 in the morning, and I was like, man, I missed this record, you know?
Yeah, well, I dig
goes.
It. That's
just
good, man. So let's say you walk out of a club one night, and you got a DeLorean sitting there, and you can go in and punch the coordinates to watch any show that's gone down, all right? Where are you
Ooh.
Going? What are you going to watch?
I'm going to Train, man. I want to see Train. You know,
Amen.
I mean, I saw in one of your questions if I could meet anyone. I was like, well, Miles. But Train, I mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, for me, I feel like he is, you know, an eternal source of inspiration, of hope, of, you know, the true essence of what I see to be, you know, what I value in this music so much, you know, total virtuosity on the instrument.
Yeah.
You know, the highest level of spirituality, right, in terms of music, you know, almost devotional music when we're talking about Love Supreme.
Yeah.
You know, so the highest level of virtuosity and spirituality without any commerciality.
Yeah. Yeah. without a doubt.
You know?
Amen. Yeah.
So for me, I mean, I love everybody, but I'll be honest, if, you know, Train to me is almost like my, you know, and many musicians, it's like our Jesus figure.
Yeah. Yep.
You know.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I can't, you know, I don't, I would have loved to meet Art Tatum.
Yeah.
I would have loved to meet Louis Armstrong, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, Miles, you know. Yeah. And, you know, that still goes for now. I mean, you know, I saw another one of your questions, you know, who would I want to, you know, who would I want to play with? I mean, for me, it's like anyone who was touched by Miles or who got to work with Miles. You know,
yeah.
When you, the, you know, it's a oral tradition, you know, spoken and also by ear, you know, heard, but it's really passed down from, you know, teacher to student, you know, as they call it in Indian class, you know, like a guru-shisha relationship, the relationship between the master and the disciple.
Yeah.
Passed down in these direct lineages, generation by generation.
Yeah.
So, you know, still, I, you know, I'm still working and still hope that someday I'd get the opportunity to work with Kenny Garrett, you know, who was with Miles, or Marcus Miller.
Yeah.
You know, or any of these guys. I mean, you know.
Absolutely.
They really set the, they really, and they're still setting the standard for what, you know, and still playing great and still making incredible music. And a lot of these band leaders are still hiring young jazz musicians. You know,
sure.
they have all young bands.
Yeah, yeah. Very
so,
cool.
So, yeah, those are the guys that continue to inspire me. And, you know, there's so many amazing band leaders and so many. There's so much great music being created in this time. It's really a special time.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm so blessed to be a part of it, you know?
Yeah, without a doubt. Let me ask you a question. What's the greatest thing about waking up every day?
Oh, God. I don't know. You know, there's just, like I said before, it's like the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. There's always something to work on.
Yeah.
There's always something to do, you know. And musically, I think, and for so much of my life up in, you know, lately, that's been the majority of my focus. But you know what? As I'm getting a little bit older, I feel like I am aging, I'm finding the need for more and more balance in my life.
Yeah.
So, you know, for so many years, it's just been about making music and just doing gigs and just, you know, trying to learn as much music and absorb as much as possible. But you know what? I honestly still have days when, like, I wake up in the morning and, you know what, I don't want to listen to music.
Yeah.
You know? Sure. Sometimes I just, like, want to go for fun or go to the gym or just go for a walk or sit in the park or, you know, try to find inspiration from other sources that I wouldn't normally tap into, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's the thing, that's the challenge, you know, is like, it's not staying inspired, but it's about finding different sources of inspiration, whether they be people, ideas, political movements, social movements, you know, world events, things like that.
Yeah.
And being able to draw inspiration from what's happening personally, culturally, spiritually, you know, and to try to make a statement about how I really feel about that and trying to make a statement through my art, through my writing, or through my solo so that I can try to convey those kinds of feelings or those kinds of ideas.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, to an unsuspecting audience.
Yeah, sure.
So that for me is where, you know, what drives me, you know, and keeps me waking up every day, you know, with, you know, thinking of different things to do and what I can do differently and how I can try to interpret, you know. Because as a jazz musician, you know, it's not the same as being like, you know, an MC or a rapper or something like that who can really say the idea.
Yeah.
You know, this is still coming from, you know, coming from a time when black musicians couldn't say what they felt.
Yeah.
They couldn't say what they, you know, what they wanted to say.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So,
absolutely.
You know, for me, I think, and I feel like a lot of artists in this day and age are really trying to take a stand for different kinds of causes and different kinds of social movements and trying to change people's hearts and minds, you know, and their perspective, just one person at a time.
Yeah.
Because you talk to a lot of young people today, they don't know what jazz is. Or you just ask them if they like jazz, and they might not know anything about it, but they just say they don't like it.
Right, right.
You know, they just have no sense of history or no sense of where the music is coming from. They don't really understand it. They don't seem like they want to understand it, you know. And I feel like it's my mission to try to change people's perspectives, you know, and their tolerance for it, one person at a time, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's I'm going to throw a scenario out. This will be my final question, and this is the scenario. Somebody catches you at Smalls, and they're talking to someone. They're like, man, you gotta dig this guy, D-O-L. Go and look him up and just find out about him a little bit. If you could construct your immaculate Google search, which is who you are, like if the perfect answer came up and said, bam, this is Theo Hill, either it's a song they could listen to or a couple sentences about who you are, what would that be?
Oh, man. Yeah, that's a very hard one. I think from what I've discovered so far in doing this is that it's about the journey. It's about the process more than any one kind of goal.
Yeah.
I think it would be all too oversimplified and just easy to say, okay, well, one Google search, let me find, you know, here's my identity with the top three searches, you know,
sure.
Or the top page. Feel like I've committed myself to the process almost to a fault. You know, I feel like I should be putting out more records and putting out more material and things like that. But I don't feel rushed.
Right.
Because cool. I'm just feel humble to the task and to just try to better myself or learn something new, or just try to take it to the next level almost on a day-by-day basis. And I feel like the greatest music, you know, that I'm going to make is yet to come.
Yeah.
You know? And I think, you know, just hope that God willing, I'll live long enough to be able to, you know, to be able to really, you know, for a lot of these kinds of things to bear fruit. But I feel like I'm still finding my voice and still developing my voice and trying to come closer to the source of that, you know, each day, you know, learning and growing and trying and failing and having the courage to try again and fail, knowing that you're probably going to fail.
Absolutely.
That's for me what it's about, you know. Granted, there have been some really great bright spots. I've had some amazing performances. I've had some incredible moments on stage. But, you know, the older I'm getting, it's like, you know, now you just want those moments instead of it to be one, you know, one run, one lick, right? One 10 seconds, 1 minute, one track, one album, right? Or one set. You want to be long, you know, extend those moments to transcend everything that you're doing.
Yeah,
so true. Every time you touch the instrument, so that every time you're in the recording studio, so that every time you sit down with the pen, you know, to compose.
Yeah.
You know, that's the, you know, for me, that's what it's about, you know.
Absolutely.
So I'd say that I'm really still more committed to the process than, you know, a final product or you know, or like you said, a Google search. But
yeah, that's cool.
I'm still trying to figure it out, man. I'm still
yeah,
trying
that's
to figure
cool.
out. It's very hard out here, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, just being an artist in this day and age, you know,
yeah.
where culturally, you know, we have a lot. We have a lot of challenges.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, not just in this country, but as you know, globally and as a you know as a world. You know,
yeah.
and I, you know, that's another thing that, you know, aside from my own personal growth or anything that I'm trying to do by myself, you know, this music is really just spiritual and it's, you know, it's about bringing people together.
Yeah.
And, you know, through music, although music is my vehicle, you know, I'd really like to think that, you know, one of my missions is to, you know, bring people together through music to try to propagate, you know, to try to get people to understand or even just think about the unification of human emotion
yeah.
across the world.
Absolutely.
And to show that we're really all not that different.
Yeah.
And that we true all
that.
Have the same love, you know, dreams and hopes. And, you know, it's really, you know, and it's through art and music that we're actually going to get together and
yeah.
work on some of this stuff, you
yeah.
know. It really, but it's these nations and languages and religions and nationalism and things like that that are keeping us divided and that
yeah.
we're using as excuses, skin color, right? You know, these kinds of things.
Yeah.
To keep us divided. You know, so I feel like aside from anything that I'm trying to do personally, I feel like I'm part of like a larger mission to try to deliver, you know, those kinds of messages to, you know, to people around the world.
Yeah,
know?
That's well said, and that's a perfect way to wrap this up. And man, it was great talking with you, man. This was awesome. I really appreciate you taking some time out to give us a little bit of time.
Joe, it's my pleasure. Really, I'm so, you know, so humbled that you reached out to me. Thank you so much for your support and for taking the time.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to yet another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in New York, Kansas City, and spots all over the USA, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to Theo Hill for his skills and enthusiasm for both jazz and the Big Apple. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino on the iTunes Store, or you can always visit theneonjazz.blogspot.com for all things Neon Jazz. Until next time, enjoy the music, my friends.
Neon Jazz.